Provincetown.
Comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients a solution for failed root canal treated teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Displaying remarkable sensitivity to the ongoing alleged negotiations between baseball's haves and those in baseball who have even more, Shyam Das, the arbitrator in charge of deciding whether contracting Major League Baseball is a reasonable business decision or a crime against us all, has delayed his decision again. That means baseball fans the world over are free to worry exclusively about whether the players will strike. One of those fans who thinks he and his fellow enthusiasts can do something other than gnash their teeth is David Friedman, the proprietor of a website called NoBaseballStrike.org. Mr. Friedman is a business consultant, and he joins me now from his office in New York. David, welcome to Only a Game.
It's great to be here.
Through your website, you have urged fans to boo player reps
on their
home teams. Now, why is that? Why make the reps the target of booing?
Well, part of Donald Fair's negotiating strategy over the years is to have the players be active participants at the table. So we need to ensure that we get a message across to those specific player representatives that we know that they're part of the bargaining process, that they can't play stupid, and that they have to understand that the fans are going to be on top of them just like we're going to be on top of the owners.
One wonders, then, why the strategy wouldn't be to cheer for the player reps, to let them know how much people want baseball to continue and are rooting for them to work toward that end.
Well, I think baseball players live in a rarefied world where negative reinforcement around the business side of the game is something that they're not used to experiencing. Player reps are typically people who are popular, the Tom Glavins of the world, for instance, or the Charles Johnsons of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And these are folks who are not used to getting booed. And we're not saying to boo them throughout the game. We're saying boo them the first time they appear in a game. So if Mike Stanton comes in to pitch to the first batter in middle relief for the Yankees, boo him as he comes in from the bullpen. Cheer him if he does well after that. But what we're saying is send a targeted message to these players.
What are some of the other strategies that you hope fans will adopt?
Well, we'll hope that they'll use our website, NoBaseballStrike.org, first of all, to sign our petition. It's actually not dissimilar to the petition that was signed by a few dozen Hall of Famers. It's a petition that essentially calls for mediation or arbitration and no work stoppage. And that's really what we're all about. We just want to see the games get played. The other thing that they can do is use our website to email their local elected representatives. We pour a lot of money as taxpayers into this game, and we also have given baseball an antitrust exemption. These are things that baseball is privileged to get. And we should let them know that, you know, we will no longer provide them with these subsidies or that we will take away their special protections. Those sorts of things should stop. That's my tax dollars going to pay for that.
There have been 8 work stoppages in Major League Baseball. Before several of these events, fans have planned strikes of their own and demonstrations and protests and all sorts of things, all to no avail.
Sure.
Why do you think either side will pay any attention to your group of fans this time around?
Well, I think a lot of the efforts that have been focused around boycotts just don't work. First of all, in the previous strikes, we really didn't have an internet that functioned very well. Even in 94, it was in its infancy. I think we now have the technology that gives us a collective political voice and a collective authority as consumers that we didn't have before. Boycotts just don't work. And one of the reasons why boycotts don't work is that baseball is just too good to miss.
Exactly. Boycotts don't work because people don't boycott it.
Exactly. I'll confess to you that I was sitting in Fenway Park in left field watching Albert Bell in the last game before the 1994 strike. There was a doubleheader at Fenway. I couldn't help myself because I just had to get my last fix.
During and after the 94 and 95 work stoppage that canceled the World Series, lots of folks said that they would never go to a ball game again. That did not appear to be the case after the Maguire-Sosa excitement and various other things. Cal Ripken, of course. Do you think that it would be different if the season were to end prematurely this time?
Strike three and you're out, as a lot of people are saying. I think it would be. I think that there are a whole bunch of other issues that are on the table that fans are just getting disgusted with at this point. I think that the steroid controversy is something that's really ruining the game. you know, if there is a strike that takes out the World Series, I don't know that I'll be a fan again. In fact, this year, it's kind of hard for me to watch games with any kind of enthusiasm because it's like watching two-thirds of a movie and not being sure if the projector is going to break.
Well, that's an interesting way to put it because at least in the projection room, they know how it's going to come out. Whereas
right.
the baseball season, theoretically, we don't.
The other thing that we're looking at is the possibility of legal action on behalf of season ticket holders who buy season ticket packages partially to have rights to buy postseason tickets. So if you bought a package of Red Sox tickets thinking that there might be postseason games this year, there was a premium within that price that you paid for the option of being able to buy the postseason tickets. And we tend to think that if the players and owners are acting in bad faith and never intended to play the postseason, that in addition to refunding the game money for the games that aren't played in the season ticket package, an extra premium for not providing the postseason option should also be refunded to the fans.
Let's get back to the petition for a minute, because isn't signing a petition saying that you don't want the baseball season to be interrupted sort of like coming out in favor of motherhood and clean water? I mean, both sides in the dispute are already on record as saying they don't want the season to be interrupted. Each one blames the other.
True, but we're offering a specific solution, and that is to rely on mediation and to rely on an arbitrator to settle this dispute. We're also trying to point out to them that from a neutral vantage point, it really looks like you've got two planes headed right for each other that are going to crash. If there's a strike, a lot of teams are going to go bankrupt. If the teams go bankrupt, they're going to discharge their debts to the players. I don't think the players and that the owners really understand how far this can go if they cancel this World Series in a good part of next year. The game will change as we know it. That's why we're saying this time, get a mediator in that both of you guys respect rather than one imposed upon you from the president. And sit down and work it out. Have the Hall of Famers help put together a committee to work this out, the Hall of Famers that signed a petition. So I think what we need here is some moral weight and some moral clarity to get everybody's attention. And these are the folks, people like Yogi Berra, these are the folks who have some moral clarity and some purity when it comes to bringing back some integrity to the game.
I've heard Yogi accused of a great many things, but clarity has never been one of them.
Yogi has a way of boiling things down to their ultimate core.
So if they come to the fork in the road in these negotiations, they should just take it.
Well, that's what we're saying. They should take it. And hopefully that route will not involve stopping play, and it will involve preserving the World Series.
David Friedman is the co-founder of NoBaseballStrike.org. David, good luck, and thank you very much for speaking with me.
It was a pleasure.
...2002 was supposed to be the year for Sacramento basketball. The NBA's Kings and the WNBA's Monarchs were ready to unseat the world champion Lakers and Sparks, respectively, except that they apparently weren't. Reporter Jason Margolis recently checked in with the Monarchs, and he has this report.
Jerry Reynolds is the former head coach of the NBA's Sacramento Kings. He now serves as their head of player personnel and as general manager of the WNBA's Sacramento Monarchs. He smolders as he watches the Monarchs at a recent shoot-around and recalls the Kings' improbable playoff elimination at the hands of the Lakers and the Monarchs' postseason loss to the Los Angeles Sparks last year.
Oh, I don't deal with it very well, to tell you the truth. I'm still pouting about it on the Kings side. Personally, I wouldn't mind if they had a big snot storm down L.A. That's the way I feel about that.
The Monarchs were prepared to do what the Kings couldn't this year. But they've played much of the season missing three of their five starters, including guard Edna Campbell, who was diagnosed with breast cancer during the offseason. Campbell has not shied away from the attention. She's used her high profile to educate people about her illness and to help others with the disease. Even as she undergoes treatment, Campbell attends as many Monarchs games as she can. She can often be seen at the end of the bench cheering on her teammates, quickly identifiable with her shaven head.
I'm just a morale supporter, you know. I just get in there and lend as much energy as I can and support and, you know, knowledge to my teammates on the occasions that I'm able to. And that's it, you know, just a little boost for them.
Campbell has had to make room at the end of the Monarchs bench for the league's top rebounder, Yolanda Griffith, who suffered from a bulging disc in her neck, and last season's assist leader, Tisha Panichero, who went down with a shoulder sprain. At one point this season, the Monarchs were in last place in the Western Conference, with a 2-14 record. Panichero says things are different now that both she and Griffith are back in the lineup.
I just feel like we, myself and Yolanda, back in the lineup, you know, the team is more confident and we have more energy and our intensity has picked up a lot. So mathematically, we're still in it. So until we are out mathematically, we're still going to fight.
And suddenly, the fighting is resulting in wins. The Monarchs have won 6 games in a row and climbed out of last place. They probably won't make the playoffs, but head coach Maura McHugh says the team can't wait to reestablish itself as one of the league's best.
We now have the attitude, look, you know, we went through some hard times and teams beat up on us, you know, and we have to remember that now. And all the teams who are having a good time beating up us, now it's our turn.
If the team doesn't make the playoffs, GM Jerry Reynolds says the Monarchs will benefit from a high draft choice next year.
Well, I feel very good about that scenario. I think that would be the one thing that could make this whole thing sort of worthwhile is if we can get a really good player out of it and have a chance to come back and even be better if we're very healthy and then get another good player.
But the best news is that the Monarchs may soon have Enda Campbell back in the lineup. Campbell says the hope of returning this year has helped her deal with her illness.
You know, you get yourself in a frame of mind and you're ready to attack. And that's the way I've dealt with it. I feel like, you know, I kind of gave the analogy of, you know, getting in the blocks and knowing where the finish line is and not seeing anything until you get to the finish line. And that's pretty much how I've approached it.
Having just finished chemotherapy and about to begin radiation, Campbell is hoping to return for the Monarchs' final home game against Seattle on August 13th. The Monarchs will host the league-best Los Angeles Sparks this afternoon. For Only a Game, I'm Jason Margolis in Sacramento.
It's 18 minutes past the hour.
Hello, I'm Mr. Red.
Thoroughbred trainers in Tasmania were initially baffled when 6 racehorses there recently tested positive for opium. What had those nags been up to? Then somebody figured out that in fields near the stables, poppies had been grown for use by the painkiller industry. The suspicion now is the seeds from those poppies have been blown into the feed or into the enclosures where the horses eat, a circumstance about which none of the horses has complained.
Hey, Wilbur, look at the Paisley sunset. Groovy!
Actually, Chris Cook, a horse trainer's representative, has said the trace elements of opium would have no effect on the behavior of the horses.
Well, listen to this.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. The downturn in the U.S. economy is starting to have an effect on one of corporate America's favorite pastimes, golf. One of the world's premier golf ball makers has already announced layoffs. To hear a report, log on to our website, WBUR.org, and click on News. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Wellington Management Company, providing investment advice to clients worldwide. In the forecast, beautiful weather today, partly sunny, very warm though, highs mid-80s near the coast and near 90 inland. Tonight's lows in the mid-60s. Tomorrow will be mostly sunny, highs 85 to 90. Come Monday, partly sunny, hot and humid. There's a 50% chance of rain on Monday afternoon, highs near 90 degrees. Cooler Tuesday, highs near 80. 72 degrees in Boston, 69 at Martha's Vineyard, 70 at Nantucket at 720.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, a book about a golf course welcoming whackers of gutta percha and wearers of knickers. But first, build it and the revenue will come is the mantra chanted by those who would have a new baseball stadium in every American metropolis, suburb, and hamlet. One slumping American city will soon put that notion to the test, to the delight of some of its citizens and the consternation of others. Jesse Hardman of member station WBEZ in Chicago has the story.
At rush hour, a block from the usually sleepy Broadway intersection, cranes and dump trucks carve at the heart of downtown Gary, Indiana, a city of around 100,000 people with one of the country's highest crime rates and lowest standards of living. Workers are racing to complete a new multi-million-dollar minor league baseball park. Residents were supposed to be cheering on their Gary South Shore Railcats this summer, the newest addition to the independent Northern League. But thanks to a cost overrun and a lawsuit brought by city councilors who say the stadium isn't needed, it's a tough finish, forcing the team to play all of its 90 games on the road.
I think the baseball stadium is a bunch of crap.
That's Joseph Thomas, the owner of Danny's Lunchbox, a corner lunch stand about a mile south of the stadium. Like most Gary residents, Thomas wants to see his town succeed. He's just not sure baseball is the way to do it.
We're a small city. We're a small city. Now, I don't think that we're going to really benefit from it. I think it's just going to be a big elephant out there. That's all I think it's going to be. Put them all downtown. Ain't nothing down there. Put them all. Get JCPenney, Sears, and all these stores to come back here. Put them all down there. Then it creates jobs, businesses. You know, that's what I think Scott should be doing instead of the damn baseball team.
Scott, as Thomas refers to him, is Gary Mayor Scott King. King's reign began in 1996, around the time riverboat casinos appeared on the banks of nearby Lake Michigan. The boats have reportedly brought more than $25 million in tax revenue to the city each year. The mayor has used that money to do everything from create local jobs to fix up the city's dilapidated downtown area. King says he's doing his best to improve the lives of Gary residents.
What they want is what anybody wants. They want their garbage picked up. They want the best possible education they can have for their children. They want their street and their house to be as nice as it possibly can be. They want to go to nice parks. They want to have a good quality of life. They want to have events in their own cities for entertainment, for dining, for whatever, that they can go to and enjoy and be proud. They want it safe.
But even King admits these are things many Gary residents are still struggling for. He says the baseball stadium will reverse Gary's trend towards crime, drugs, and poverty.
There's enough examples of these being successful. Is it overnight? No. But, you know, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with one step, and you have to take these preliminary steps.
Lloyd McClendon, the current manager of the Pittsburgh Pirates, is also a Railcats partner. Watching his team take batting practice at Chicago's Wrigley Field, McClendon smiles as he recounts his childhood in Gary.
I played Little League on 13th Avenue and for Anderson Little League. We made it all the way to the Little League World Series. So it's a proud area with rich tradition, and we've taken our knocks, but I think we're on the rise again.
McClendon still makes his home in Gary during baseball's offseason, and he still drives by local baseball fields he used to play on as a kid, now marked by rusted backstops and high grass. McClendon says he's counting on the new ballpark to revive his city.
Certainly, you know, the money that they're putting in, I would hope that it's going to be well spent and people can see the spinoff of it quite quickly. I think with the number of jobs that it's going to generate, hopefully it'll bring in hotels, more restaurants. Employment should rise and should bring a better picture and a positive feel about what we're trying to do in the city of Gary.
Like McClendon, local County Commissioner Rudy Clay is a Gary native son. Much of his last campaign centered on an anti-baseball platform. Clay says he'd love to have a team in Gary, but he says the national pastime won't solve his city's problems.
We have schools that are falling apart, and you're spending $52 million on a baseball stadium. We have the highest homicide rate of any city in the United States of America, and you're saying, well, take me out to the ball game and buy me some peanuts and popcorn and Cracker Jacks. I mean, we've got some serious problems in this town, and $52 million could solve a lot of them.
Clay says he wants casino funds to be spent on more practical things, like paying down local property taxes, which at around 30% are some of the highest in the country. Sports economist Rob Boddy of Lake Forest College in suburban Chicago agrees with Clay. He says Gary needs more than minor league baseball.
I've looked at every single major league city, and there is no correlation between new stadiums, teams, and economic activity. If people are struggling to make financial ends meet because the Gary economy is depressed, are they really going to have the income to pay for entertainment activities? I think the whole strategy has some, I think, pretty clear flaws, and I doubt very much that this is a strategy that is workable.
Boddy says a new stadium will mean new business and jobs, but not enough to warrant the millions of dollars invested by the city.
Group 1's going to start their BP.
At a recent practice, Railcats slugger Jermaine Swinton, the Northern League's home run king last year, steps into the batting cage and muscles balls into the sky. He hopes to make the big leagues, so Swinton says he's not sure he'll be around for next year's inaugural home opener at the team's new stadium. But he says if he is, he'll do his best to give Gary residents something to cheer about.
Hopefully building the stadium downtown could kind of, you know, get the downtown area rebuilt and bring the downtown area back to life. There's always room for entertainment, and basically that's what we are. We're, you know, on the field, we're baseball players, but to the fans, we're entertainment. And if we could, you know, help something to liven up the downtown area of Gary and help, you know, give it a shot in the arm, you know, then you know, that's great.
For Only a Game, I'm Jesse Hardman in Gary, Indiana.
Some landscapes bring together shape and curve and light in a feeling of perfect assembly. So write Paula DiPerna and Vicki Keller in a new book examining the creation of the restoration of America's first golf course. The title of the book and the name of the course is Oakhurst, and Paula DiPerna joins me now in the studio. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Oakhurst was first established, and I hope that that's not too grand a term in this context, in 1884. And I gather that as far as you could establish, only five gentlemen ever played the course regularly.
Right. The course was the brainchild of two gentlemen at first, one named Russell Montague. Russell was owned a piece of land in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia, which is indeed the piece of land called Oakhurst. And his neighbor was a fellow named George Grant, and Grant had been born in Scotland. Grant had a cousin who was coming to visit, a fellow named Lionel Torrin, who was also a Scotsman. And he, Lionel, was a well-known golfer in India and in England and Scotland and Ceylon, where he was actually growing tea. And he felt he needed a break from tea. And so he decided to come to America for a couple of months. And his cousin George got a little nervous that Lionel was going to be hanging around more or less with very little to do if he couldn't play golf. So George asked Russell if possibly they could build a golf course on Russell's land. And Russell said, sure. And there were two other Scotsmen in the picture by then who were friends of Grant, apparently, from Scotland. So these five people all found themselves drawn to this one very beautiful part of West Virginia and then gave birth to the golf course.
One of the rules, in effect, in those days was that if your golf ball broke apart, which I gather they did fairly frequently, you had to finish the hole by hitting the largest part of the ball which you could find. It must have made for some multi-putt greens.
Well, indeed. I don't know how many putts, because a lot of the records were burned, but gutta percha was the sap of a tree that was an Asian tree, and gutta percha was used for all kinds of things, false teeth, insulating wires. And so in the 1880s, the golf balls were made of this gutta percha, which is very hard but very breakable, and when they got dried out, they broke. As to how many putts people had, Lionel Torrin, you know, the first golf poem written in America was written at Oakhurst about putting, and Torrin was apparently lost the hole, and he walked off in disgust and said, I expect to putt in hell on a green like this. So and Montague wrote him a little poem about that later on just to cool him off.
Well, we better hear the poem.
They play in hell on a slippery green with a red-hot iron and a melting cleek. With a driver on fire and a brimstone ball, and the putter too hot to hold at all. And the devil Dormy with fiendish glee says, play one more round through eternity. So if you're a golfer, you're going to be damned to putt badly in hell. So you better, I guess, go to heaven.
Get used to it.
Or get used to it, one or the other, right.
The National Hickory Championship takes place. It's going on today, as a matter of fact, at Oakhurst. Will the old rules apply, including having to play the largest piece of your broken gutta percha ball that you can find?
They do follow the 1880s rules, which also include that you have to putt around your opponent's ball.
No marking of the ball.
No marking of the ball.
Mm-hmm.
This is an annual event where only hickory shafts, at minimum hickory shafts, are allowed, and ideally only the 1880s replica clubs. And the players actually wear 1880s equipment. And on some level, that sounds sort of absurd and highly idealized. But actually, these are very contemporary people and very modern players who simply have found that they prefer the game in the dimensions that are achievable with hickory shafts as opposed to, you know, the metal shafts and the graphite and the titanium that we're all used to in the modern game.
Well, and in fact, it would not really be sporting to play Oakhurst with contemporary equipment because the course is built for short hitting.
Exactly. You would drive over every green with today's equipment. I mean, for example, the entire nine-hole course is 2,235 yards. The first hole, which is 226 yards in total, that's a par four in 1880s parlance, which means it's a two-shotter, which is essentially two shots to get on the green in regulation. And no one has ever done that. The only person who's ever done that bounced on.
Sam Snead, the great pro golfer born and raised in West Virginia, had the honor of hitting the first shot on the reconstituted Oakhurst course, but I gather that that particular historical event did not go quite as well as it might have gone.
Well, I wish I had been there. It was one of the great, great stories of golf lore, I think, including the final quip, which is sort of unforgettable. But what happened was Sam was had known about this golf course for many years. He had been born in the vicinity, and he actually introduced Lou Keller to the Montague descendant, who still owned the course in 1959. So Sam actually saved probably Oakhurst from becoming condominiums at that point. And so in 1994, when the course was reopened after the Kellers restored it, Sam, of course, was there to participate. And he was given a special club that had been made for him by Carlson Solheim's company, which was had a metal head and a wooden shaft. And Sam got up there on the par three, which is the only real chance you have at Oakhurst to make a hole in one. It's 106 yards over this incredible ravine, very mucky, very beautiful, but very tough little gaping ravine. And so Sam stands up there, tees up, and takes a swing with this quasi-modern, you know, modern head and not-so-modern shaft. And I suppose the physics of it weren't too good to begin with. But on top of that, as we all know, Sam had a magnificent swing and a very fluid, strong swing. And so apparently he took it back with no problem. But when he made contact and hit the ball, the club broke. And the club head went off in the same direction as the ball. Sam, being concerned with only one thing, namely playing golf, looks up and says to everybody, "Well, did either one of them get on the green?" And I think neither the clubhead nor the golf ball made it across the ravine, and he was pretty unhappy about that.
Now, authenticity dictates that even now, sheep should be grazing on the course. That must make for an interesting obstacle for current golfers.
Well, interestingly, the sheep sort of have an innate sense of where not to be when there's a lot of play going on. I mean, they move, of course, as a flock, sort of as a group, and somehow if you just sort of stand there and wait long enough, they get out of your way. And if you want to, you can try to hit over them, but I think it was Tom Watson who decided he didn't really want to try to hit over them, and he waited a pretty long time before he made his second shot into the green on nine the time he played there.
Paula DiPerna is the co-author of Oakhurst, The Birth and Rebirth of America's First Golf Course, published by Walker Books. Thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Only a Game. Even if you're not a golfer, you've got to kind of like the idea of the reestablishment of a course that's more than 100 years old and the subsequent imposition of rules prohibiting the use of contemporary equipment on the ancient grounds. The technology of golf has reached a point where some of the clubs and balls developed over the last few years so dramatically alter the game that they've been outlawed for competition, even on our monstrously long contemporary courses. Didn't I read somewhere recently that the golf club and golf ball industries were scooping up engineers laid off by NASA? I don't think I could have made that up. Something similar has happened in baseball, though, for different reasons. Some of the kids' leagues and college programs that embraced unbreakable bats for economic reasons have moved away from the high-tech models because balls come off them so quickly that pitchers in the line of fire have no chance to defend themselves. The introduction of space-age materials into tennis rackets changed that game a while back, and ever since, purists have been complaining that tennis has become much less interesting, How long can you be entertained by two guys firing unreturnable 125-mile-an-hour serves past each other? There is even an argument that the current generation of ice hockey and football helmets has made those games more dangerous rather than safer. The reasoning is that the indestructible equipment encourages stupid risks in players who feel invulnerable, and the helmets serve as weapons as well. In the context of a world where technology can push our games past rational limits, as surely as illicit pharmacology can propel the athletes themselves into uncharted territory, the story of an old short course where players are limited to handcrafted, beautiful, and relatively inefficient tools makes for a lovely contrast. The Olympic motto is faster, stronger, higher, and nowhere on any playing field will you find anyone aspiring towards slower, weaker, and lower. But it's nice to be reminded that our games began on a simpler scale, a scale that it's awfully tempting to characterize now as more human. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Trader Joe's, a unique grocery store with foods and beverages, from all-natural sodas to thaw and serve French desserts. Trader Joe's store location information available at TraderJoe's.com. Good morning. I'm Dolores Handy. In sports headlines, the Red Sox beat the Rangers 13-0 last night in Texas. Game 3 of their series is tonight. Sox ace Pedro Martinez has been named American League Pitcher of the Month for July. Overall, during July, Martinez struck out 59, allowed only 3 earned runs, 22 hits, and no home runs. Another Sox ace pitcher, Derek Lowe, along with catcher Jason Varitek and second baseman Ray Sanchez, have received suspensions from Major League Baseball for their role in a bench-clearing brawl at Fenway with the Baltimore Orioles last week. All appealed. Lowe was suspended for 5 games, Varitek for 4, Sanchez for 3. Sox pitching coach Tony Kloniger was suspended for 2 games. As for Baltimore, Willis Roberts was suspended for 7 games, Melvin Mora for 4. 8 other players were fined. In the forecast, partly sunny, very warm today, highs in the mid-80s to near 90. Many of the books you hear about on Only a Game are available through our website. Just go to onlyagame.org and click on Public Radio Store. And remember, part of every purchase helps pay for the news on WBUR.
Venice was once a center of trade, with spices, wine, and oil passing through the city on the way to the east or west. I'm Alex Chadwick. Venice has changed, but the spirit of those early days remains. I hope you'll join me this December on our next Citizens of the World tour. The proceeds help pay for the news.
For more information, call 800-909-9287.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, we'll examine an increasingly popular form of self-defense, Krav Maga. But first, here to discuss with me the week's sports news is Only a Game analyst Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Allegations of fixed Olympic competition shook the international figure skating and ice dancing communities this week, Charlie, when it was learned that alleged Russian mobster Alimzan Takhtakunov may have contacted as many as 6 judges at the Salt Lake City Olympics, which had already been tarnished by a judging scandal. Are you among the appalled?
This is a level of corruption and danger that takes figure skating out of the kind of corrupt burlesque it was last winter and throws it into deeper and darker waters. The involvement of the, in the broadest term, Russian mafia in sports is a story that the National Hockey League, among other people, has been desperately trying to bury for about 5 years.
A long time, yeah.
Mr. Tokhtakhinov apparently is also very good friends with a number of tennis players, including Evgeny Kafelnikov and Murat Safin. These guys don't take prisoners. These people behead people when they don't pay their debts. These are the real things. This is not Marie-Rene Lagoon doing her scrapyard thing in the ice dance competition. And what has become very plain to me, Bill, is that figure skating should be eliminated from the Olympics until such time as it can conduct itself cleanly.
My favorite quote stemming from this whole mess is Friday's denial by French Skating Federation President Didier Gayouguet. He said, quote, "In the name of the French Skating Federation and my own name, I affirm very clearly that we had no relation, no contact directly or indirectly, either before, during, or after the Olympic Games with Mr. Tokhtakhinov concerning the events in question," end quote. Then he went on to say that the French Federation had met with the purported gangster 2 years ago.
Once again, you're dealing with a sport that is completely incapable of conducting itself in an above-board and honorable manner. My favorite quote in the whole thing was ESPN reporting that one of the wiretaps that caught Mr. Tokhtakhinov talking about an alleged fix said of this one of the skaters, "Even if she falls, she will win. But it would be best if she did not fall."
Well, you can't blame him for his judgment as far as the value of the competition, right? It is better if they don't fall.
It makes the fraud far less obvious if they stay on their feet.
Meanwhile, Charlie, there was no decision from arbitrator Shyam Das this week concerning whether Major League Baseball can eliminate two of its teams. Do you suppose he was too busy watching to see if his favorite team made any good deals before Wednesday's trading deadline?
Well, I think, and I don't blame Mr. Das on this one, I think he's trying to figure out what exactly Major League Baseball is doing here. During the week, Major League Baseball, which runs the Montreal Expos, traded Cliff Floyd to the Red Sox for essentially a bag of doorknobs from the minor leagues.
The proverbial bag of doorknobs.
Exactly right. And this, of course, also brings up the pending lawsuit by the minority partners of the old Montreal Expos group, who will look at this and see the Red Sox ownership as the bobos of the toy commissioner's office. So if Mr. Das's head is spinning a little bit at this point, I don't blame him. If he wants to take more time, that's fine.
I would like to see both the players and the owners trade away the guys heading their negotiating teams, but I don't suppose that's very likely.
No, that's not going to happen, no. because the people doing negotiating for both sides are doing exactly what both sides want them to do.
Though he did afterward issue what seemed a genuine apology, Cincinnati Reds general manager Jim Bowden earned this week's Cup of Ill Cheer Award after he compared the possible baseball strike with the September 11th attacks.
Well, he did worse than that. He said, if they do walk out, make sure it's September 11th. Be symbolic. Let Donald Fear drive the plane right into the building, if that's what they want to do. Consider the precedent in Cincinnati where they threw Marge Schott out of baseball because she had Nazi memorabilia in her drawer 50 years after the end of World War II. Less than a year after what happened in New York, this moron says something like this. He should be suspended from baseball for at least a year.
I suppose we should give him credit for at least recognizing he had something to apologize for and then apologizing sincerely.
No, I don't give him any credit for that at all.
Early this week, all but two of the 14 charges previously filed against Allen Iverson were dismissed. Iverson is still charged with two counts of making terroristic threats. That leaves him about five charges shy of what was brought against the two WorldCom execs who were led away in handcuffs while the media watched and recorded it all.
Well, Allen Iverson at least works for his money. You know, this was predictable. I mean, he was overcharged in the first place. The prosecutors are now wondering if they can charge him at all. Some witnesses says, well, it wasn't a gun. It might have been his pager. This all took place at a time of day where nothing good can come of anything. It's not surprising to me that the witnesses have started to either recant or rearrange or find their stories in conflict. He will be convicted of a misdemeanor or two, do some community service, and that will be the end of the story.
One of the witnesses, for the record, said, I'd be happy to drop the charges for $100,000.
Was he contacted later by an official of the Russian Figure Skating Federation or not?
Meanwhile, L.A. Laker Shaquille O'Neal has apparently been using his offseason to build an empire of sorts, and it has nothing to do with basketball. Should we change his nickname from the Big Aristotle to the Big Aristotle Onassis?
How about this? He's building houses. his dream, he says, is to own $1 billion a year in affordable housing. He is a partner with a preservation corporation in Portland, Maine. He's going to buy 21 communities around the country and put up low-income housing. This is one of these things where you hope there's follow-through and you hope he actually does it, because it really is a terrific idea.
Absolutely. In a game between Los Angeles and Miami Tuesday night, Lisa Leslie became the first WNBA player to dunk during a game. Her teammates were apparently delighted, although I'm not sure why this was such a big deal. Lisa Leslie is 6'5". Why shouldn't she dunk?
Well, it was the first real one in professional competition. The WNBA has the NBA's hype machine behind it. That's why there was a lot of publicity. It would have been nice if the Sparks had won the game, which they didn't.
No, they didn't. They lost the game. NFL exhibition games begin this weekend.
Bill,
are you ready?
I can tell.
Are you ready for some football?
I can tell. You walked in here on a cloud. I can tell.
Finally, Charlie, here's a case of you'd better build something because they've already come to see it. South Korean tourists in great numbers have been arriving in the Netherlands to see the home of coach Gus Hiddink, who led the South Korean World Cup so ably, and now folks in Hiddink's hometown will oblige tourists. They're building a museum.
What a nice thing. This is usually when you put like groups of Dutch together regarding soccer, it doesn't come to a good end. Maybe not making the field this year has mellowed them out a little bit.
Charlie Fierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and for Esquire magazine as well. He's a regular here at Only a Game, and I would tell you where he lives, except that then they'd probably have to build a museum there as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Das vidanya, Bill. Have a buck.
And up the nation on the sand, a bit of a painter, darum sing a bay, darum hoss a bay. And up the nation on the sand, a bit of a painter, darum sing a bay, over all.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. In the hallway outside a basement room in the Gold's Gym in Braintree, Massachusetts, the members of an unlikely group of combatants prepare to punch, strangle, and kick one another. Men and women together, they range in age from late teens to late 50s, in weight from 110 or so to about 275. Many of them are dressed in the loose-fitting clothing favored by those who practice judo, karate, and various other martial arts. Once they've all wrapped their hands in elastic bandages, one of their instructors, Sean Burgo, leads them and me into the room. First trick is opening the door without a handle.
Indeed. To start off, they say that we're pretty informal. Yes and no. We're informal in that if people need to grab water, they need to run off the mat because, you know, they're going to throw up, which does happen sometimes because we run a very intense class. They can feel free to do that. But we do keep a pretty formal class. In fact, we do bow in and we bow out. And actually, if you give me just a moment, I'm going to bow in.
Bowing in consists of Sean and his fellow instructor, Christopher Liska, acknowledging their students with a nod. Then the students acknowledge their instructors, and then the Krav Maga begins. Unlike the better-known martial arts, most of which originated in Asia, Krav Maga, which means contact combat in Hebrew, began in Europe. Across the United States, Krav Maga has become increasingly popular, following articles about it in newspapers and magazines. Developed over the course of several years by a man named Emi Lichtenfeld, this constantly evolving set of combat moves and strategies, now best known as the discipline taught to soldiers in the Israeli army, is less about harmony and grace than it is about disabling somebody who's trying to disable you. In a situation like that, Sean Burgo says it's results that count.
We teach you how to deal with what you don't expect. You know, things that you will see. You're sitting at a bar, someone comes up behind you, chokes you. You know, maybe you're a woman, someone's trying to grab you, drag you into the bushes, something to that effect. We teach you how to deal with that and go from there. It's what works, is what we like to say.
According to Krav Maga instructors, what works depends on who you are. As Sean Burgo points out, in Israel, virtually all the citizens serve in the military, so Krav Maga has to work for everybody.
It doesn't matter what your body type is, what you look like, man or woman, you got to serve. To someone smaller, then we tend to have them use speed. You go for very soft, weak targets. You know, you go for the eyes, you go for the throat, you go for the nose.
While Sean Burgo explains, Chris Liska organizes the students into pairs of punching, kicking, grunting battlers.
I want you to start out nice and comfortable, throwing combinations into the pad. Okay? Good work.
Those least familiar with the act of throwing a punch are told to begin by pretending they're picking a can of soda off a shelf and putting it back. Then they're told to do it more and more quickly. Those fielding the punches with heavy plastic pads are instructed to keep their hands up. But some of the students tire quickly, and one slender fellow absorbing the punches ends up leaning against the wall. Before fatigue can claim any more of the students, Chris Liska introduces a new exercise. The punchers are told to lie down in the center of the room with their eyes closed. Their partners, still holding the pads, walk around the room. At the instructor's signal, the students in the circle jump up and try to locate the people they're supposed to punch, pushing each other out of the way to get to their assigned targets. After a couple of rounds of this, most of the students seem ready to welcome an opportunity to just watch, as Chris Liska demonstrates, with Sean Burgo as assistant and punching bag, another technique.
This particular kick is not a little flick kick. I'm actually trying to kick Sean in the chin, but I'm going to get there through his groin. I'm going to come up underneath him, almost like I'm trying to pick him up off the ground. I want your upper body to stay as relaxed as possible and just fire the kick straight up in there. We're here. Right back. One kick to the groin.
When Sean has relinquished his role as thug and mugger, I can't help telling him I'm glad he's still in one piece and wondering whether that can always be said of all the people absorbing these kicks.
I gotta ask, what do these people have to sign before they come in here? Because all you need is for one person to not hold that pad very well, and one of those kicks...
We do have a waiver. Just, you know, basically we tell people right off the bat what they're in for, how physically it's going to be. What you will never see is, say, like the two gentlemen in the front of the class who are definitely, you know, about 6 feet, a good 250 or so. They wouldn't be with, say, our person Allison, who's about 5 feet and lucky if she's a buck 20.
Interestingly, Allison, the slender 31-year-old, looks much more comfortable than most of the students with all the kicking and punching. She's been studying Krav Maga for 5 months and has moved well beyond the novice level. During a break between the 2 one-hour workouts she's getting on this evening, she explains one of the more challenging drills she's encountered.
I will have one person in a circle and three people around you. And what will happen is one person will come up and choke you, and you'll use your combatives to get out of that choke. And right when you're just about out of that choke hold, that second person comes up and chokes you. They might give you a different kind of choke. You get out of that, and as soon as you get out of that, someone else is giving you a choke. It could be a front choke. It could be a side choke. It could be, you know, from the back, from behind. And you just instinctively are going to use your combatives. And people really come at you.
As she speaks, Allison is joined by two other students taking a water break between classes. David Resnick and Chris Slattery have both been practicing Krav Maga for 9 months, and David says he can feel the benefits.
It makes me feel maybe more confident. It doesn't make me feel cocky at all. I think it sort of gives you a sense that if anything was to ever happen, you could defend yourself. Because you saw what we're doing here, and it's pretty intense.
This is kind of a perverse question, but do you ever find yourself thinking, all right, I've been at this for 6 months, 9 months, a year, whatever it is, I like to try it out. I hope somebody tries something.
What I found out is that I've learned how little I know about fighting. So I'm almost going the other way. And I'm, you know, I see something, I know enough to leave the area. Maybe in a few years I might get a little bit more cocky, but I doubt it.
I don't think you will. We had a class in here Tuesday night where we put on boxing gloves and pads on the legs, and you really go at it. And you realize, Chris said, you really learn how much you don't know about fighting. I was down on the ground pretty quickly.
The theory is that if any of the Krav Maga students is ever to find him or herself in a dangerous situation, the training will keep that student off the ground and out of trouble. Will it work? All the practice punching and kicking and choking notwithstanding, even Sean Burgo and Chris Liska hope that none of their students will ever have to find out.
Like that perfume from Spain. I'm sure that if I took even one sniff, that would bore me terrifically too. Yet I get a kick out of you. I get a kick every time.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Tad Curry. We had help this week from Jason Trainer. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again, learn more about Oakhurst, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Krav Maga instructor Chris Liska, who offers the following self-defense tip.
This time I'm already loaded. I have to pivot my back foot, almost like I'm squashing a bug.
Oh, come on. Anybody can get loaded and squash a bug. You don't need a class to learn how to do that. Just silly. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Nothing to do, yet I get a kick out of you.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, educating discerning patients and dentists since 1985 about their options for the replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WBUR. This is WBUR.